back in the book of Genesis. And last week, Jacob and his family had gone back to Bethel, to the stone in which he had seen the vision of the angels. And there he built an altar and offered sacrifice, and they worshiped there at Bethel. On his way back, Rachel gives birth to Jacob's 12th and final son, creating the 12 tribes of Israel. And this is Benjamin, the youngest. Benjamin means son of my right hand. So it is a calling upon this child to support Jacob in his old age. He sees this child as being the one who will care for him in his old age. And he develops a very, very close relationship with his son Benjamin, which comes to play later. But unfortunately, in that act of childbirth, Rachel dies. Rather than try to take her back, her body back to Machpelah, to the cave there, where Abraham and Isaac had been buried, he chooses to bury her on the side of the road, builds a small shrine for her there on the side of the road, which is still there to this day. The Jews still go to the tomb of Rachel, separated from the patriarchs, the tomb of the patriarchs, which is in Hebron. And there has been some discussion, of course, like everything that's this ancient, people discuss, you know, where is this tomb of Rachel? Is it, I think there's more than one possibility, one in Bethlehem and another one further north in Ramah. But it is still revered, still reverenced by the Jews to this day. And we talked about how Rachel, though she was lovely, was a bit of a conniver and had hidden the idols from Laban. Now Jacob takes it on himself. He sees himself as being the cause of Rachel's death, because he had issued that proclamation: if anybody has taken the idols of Laban, they shall die. And so when she dies, although she dies years later and in childbirth, he still sees that as his fault. He had cursed her. He had pronounced the death sentence, and now she has perished. There's another reason why this tight relationship that Jacob has with Benjamin and with the other daughter of Rachel, who is Joseph. Who?
The other son of Rachel.
Yeah, the other son of Rachel. Very good. I know, I get a lot of things wrong, don't I? Thanks for correcting. I'm so glad you listened so carefully. Now, there's a little interlude there about Esau that talks about all the descendants of Esau and how the Edomites came from him and how he marries a Hittite princess. So there's a whole tribe of the Hittites that come from Esau. And there's all of these different peoples in the land, because Esau's kind of gone with the Canaanites, and he's taken on several Canaanite wives, Hittite wives, and so he's building up this huge following. This all it appears here, but it really doesn't come to play here. It comes to play when Israel leaves Egypt, and they come back and wind up doing battle against the descendants of Esau. So Jacob has become Israel. He's eventually going to go to Egypt. When he comes back, the descendants of Israel and now are fighting the descendants of Esau. We'll see that come into play. Well, like I say, Jacob loves Joseph and Benjamin. They are his favorite sons because they came from his beautiful wife. And Jacob gives Joseph a coat of many colors. Sometimes these scholars call it a coat with long sleeves, neither of which are really very good translations of it. In Hebrew, it's the pasim. And the pasim is it's a very specific type of ornamental robe that is worn by royalty. It's a symbol of royal office. Exactly how Jacob came about this robe or whether he had it made, we don't know. But he gives this to Joseph to exalt Joseph above his brothers. And he seems to be totally clueless that this is going to cause problems with his brothers. We've already had kind of an inkling of what his brothers are like. Remember Dinah, who fell in love with the Canaanite in Shechem and was, and they went through and they killed everybody. These are rough guys. And it probably was not the wisest thing Jacob had done to put this, give this robe to him that exalted him as brothers above his brothers, because trouble is going to come of that. What makes the matters worse is Joseph starts having dreams. And that is one of the things that is famous about Joseph. Joseph has these amazing dreams. And in one of them, he dreams of these sheaves of barley that surround him and bow down to him. And in a second dream, he sees himself with the sun, the moon, and the stars all bowing down to him. And Joseph, being young and a little inexperienced, he shares these dreams with his brothers, which again just adds fuel to the fire. So Joseph's brothers, well, 10 of his brothers, because Benjamin is not included in this. Benjamin is at home with dad because Benjamin doesn't have to go out into the fields to work. And really, actually, for that matter, neither does Joseph. His brothers are all out working, tending the flocks, and Joseph is staying home. But Jacob sends him with an errand to give them a message. So he shows up, they see him coming, and they say, "Here he comes, here comes the dreamer," they say, "let's kill him." Well, the oldest of the brothers, Reuben, says, "That's probably not what we should do. Why don't we just throw him in a pit, let him die on his own. That way his blood is not on our hands. He dies by himself in this pit." So that's what they do. Now, the Bible tells us that Reuben, who's the oldest brother, has some sense. And his idea is he's going to come back later and rescue Joseph. He doesn't want to kill Joseph. But things turn awry. Reuben apparently seems to be away from the rest of his brothers at some point, doing something, maybe going to seek a sheep that's lost. We don't really know. And they see some Ishmaelite traders, a caravan comes passing by. So the brothers say, "Hey, you know, if we kill him, we get nothing. But if we sell him, then we'll get some money out of this deal." So that's exactly what they do. They pull Joseph out of the pit. They take his ornamental robe. They sell him to the Ishmaelites to be traded into Egypt. And they kill an animal and they pour its blood all over the robe so they can take it back to Jacob and convince him that Joseph is dead. It's exactly how that calls to play. Now, if you've been reading through chapter 38, is a complete interruption in the story. Exactly why it's there, I don't know. Judah goes and gets a Canaanite wife. He kind of slips the way of of Esau. He goes out and he gets a Canaanite wife. He has some children. One of his sons gets married. He dies, leaving his wife, Judah's daughter-in-law, childless. And so we've seen this happen before. She's not going to be childless. She tricks Judah into sleeping with her, and she has two children by Judah, her father-in-law. When he hears about it, he wants to kill her, but she took his seal so she could say, "Look, these are your children," and so that way the children live. A couple of interesting things come out of that chapter. We mention it because there are a few interesting things. First, this cultural concept that the worst thing that can happen to anyone is to be childless. The worst thing that can happen to any woman is to be childless. It's the, you know, incest is better than being barren. And so we had seen this with Lot's daughters who committed incest with him so that they could have children. And now we see it with Tamar, who is Judah's daughter-in-law, who tricks him into sleeping with her so she can have children. The worst thing that can happen to a woman is to be childless. We even see this going into the New Testament, where Paul says a woman is saved by bearing children. That actually her salvation is linked to that. So there's very, very strong cultural sense that barrenness is the worst that there can be. Another couple of other interesting notes is that, again, we see the cultural impact of more, everything has to be moral. Everything has to have a moral reason. And so when Judah's sons die, leaving Tamar barren or childless, it's because God's angry with them. Everything has to be moralized. God is angry, and that's why they died. And we kind of carry that sometimes into our own, you know, Christian perspective, where we see bad things happen and think, well, God must be angry. And no, that's not at all the case. Jesus makes that very clear. God doesn't get mad at us and punish us, right? We do stupid things, and sometimes stupid things cause troubles in our lives, but it's not because God's angry with us. It's because we do something stupid. A third interesting thing about this chapter, and again, this is an interrupted chapter, but there are a couple of reflections, is that the heritage of the Messiah comes from Judah's relationship with Tamar. So, now, why is that? And in fact, if you read the lineage of the Messiah, I know everybody really loves that first chapter of Matthew. We all read it very carefully and look up every character in there. But when you look through the characters in that genealogy of Jesus, you see a lot of blips. A lot of people in that lineage who were not the people you would expect. And I think that is just to show that Christ comes from where we are. We are broken people. And Christ's lineage comes from broken people. He is the Son of God, but in his humanity, he comes from our brokenness. So not only Tamar, who is this tricker, we also, when we get to the story of Joshua coming into the Promised Land, the harlot Rahab is in the lineage of Jesus. David had 300 wives, all right, but the lineage of the Messiah comes from Bathsheba, again, a questionable figure. So out of our brokenness, the humanity of Christ comes. Enough said, like I say, it's kind of an interruptive chapter. Chapter 39 resumes the story about Joseph. Joseph's been sold to Egypt. He is given to, he is purchased by a Hebrew named, by an Egyptian named Potiphar. He's a court official. He's kind of high up and a very powerful person, wealthy man, probably has lands and fields and cattle and spends time tending those. Maybe a bit of a workaholic, we don't know. But his wife feels neglected, and she thinks this young, handsome Hebrew is pretty hot stuff. So she wants Joseph to sleep with her. Now, from an Egyptian's perspective, this is perfectly normal. You can demand your slave to have sex with you at any time, and they have to do it. And it wasn't considered to be anything wrong to have sex with your slave. That's what they were, one of the things they were there for. So she is really upset when Joseph says, no, that is a sin, and I will not sin against God. So she, again, she takes his cloak, right? She takes his cloak. There's a theme here, right? This cloak thing is becoming an issue. She takes his cloak, she shows it to her husband. Joseph runs away naked, by the way. She shows it to her husband and says, Joseph, that slave you bought, tried to rape me. And I grabbed his coat and drove him away. So now Joseph is in a huge amount of trouble for doing what was right. All right, let's revisit what we talked about in the last chapter. The Hebrews want to have this morality to everything, that when we do good, God blesses. When bad things happen, it must be because God is angry. Here is Joseph being the perfect, upright man, and he winds up being accused and condemned for his perfection, for his uprightness. Where do we see this again in Scripture? In this regard, Joseph is a type of Christ because he was thrown into the dungeon for the sake of his righteousness, just as Jesus was condemned for the sake of his righteousness. Well, incidentally, something I didn't notice, I think it's in your notes that I didn't mention. When Joseph is sold by his brothers, he's sold for silver, for pieces of silver. Right, you see, Joseph is becoming this prefigure of Christ. And then he's thrown into the dungeon, and he is left there for 3 years. He spends 3 years in the dungeon, just as Christ was 3 days in the grave. This prefiguring of Christ starts to develop in the life of Joseph. But just, of course, as Christ was resurrected, Joseph will have a resurrection, although we're not quite there yet. While he's in prison, Joseph meets a couple of court officials who are also prisoners, and they have dreams. Joseph is the dream man. So they go to Joseph and they say, "Here are our dreams." And Joseph interprets those dreams. He tells the baker, "Your dream means that you will be executed and the birds will peck out your eyes." But he says to the other man, the cupbearer, that he will be restored to his position and he will become important to Pharaoh. Now, a cupbearer, we don't even have cupbearers. We don't know what cupbearers are. But cupbearers are very, very important people in the court. They were right there beside the king, or in this case, the Pharaoh, at all times. And nothing went to Pharaoh, directly to Pharaoh. It all went through the cupbearer. Now, the reason it's called the cupbearer is he really, in medieval monarchies, they would have a taster, right? Everything that goes to the king, somebody else has to taste. And that's what he does. He takes the cup, he takes a sip, he doesn't die, gives it to the Pharaoh. You know, anything that comes to the Pharaoh, he tastes it. If he doesn't die, he passes it on. But he's also a counselor to the Pharaoh. He's very, very important character. So anyway, we're still talking about dreams. Pharaoh has a dream, and his dream, he has two dreams, and two is important, because that's one of the ways you know that you have a dream in which God is speaking to you, because you have the same dream twice, maybe a little twist on it. Remember, Joseph had two dreams, the sheaves of barley and the sun, moon, and stars. And now Pharaoh has two dreams, and he has a dream of seven handsome cows that come out of the Nile, but they were eaten by seven ugly cows. And then he has a dream of seven full, beautiful ears of grain, and they are eaten by seven squalid ears of grain. And he doesn't know what to do with these dreams, but he's had two of them, so he knows that a god must be speaking to him. So he calls in his magicians. It is the job of the Egyptian magicians to interpret dreams. And they have a manual. They believe it or not, we actually have a copy of this. There's a manual of dream interpretation that was used by the Egyptian magicians. So they look it up, right? If you saw yourself in a dream and you were eating, that means that's a good omen. You're going to get rich. But if you saw yourself in a dream and you were starving, that's a bad omen. You're going to be poor. And they had all these different ways of interpreting dreams. It's all in their manual. We have websites for that sort of thing today. But anyway, this dream was bizarre. It wasn't in the book. The cows, the ears of grain getting eaten by not in the book. They couldn't interpret it. So, the cupbearer, remember? Right there by Pharaoh at all times. He's counselor to Pharaoh. And he says, "I know somebody who can interpret your dream for you. I ran into him in prison, as a matter of fact. And he's a smart guy." So they bring Joseph up. Joseph interprets the dreams and says the dreams mean this. The country will have 7 years of plenty. Lots of rain, lots of water, lots of harvest. It's going to be good. Good times. But they'll be followed by 7 years of famine. 7 years of hard times. So Pharaoh says, you're a smart man, Joseph. I'm putting you in charge. Joseph then becomes Pharaoh's viceroy. He is his second in command, and he is responsible to prepare the nation for the 7 years of famine. Now, who is this Pharaoh? Well, the Bible doesn't tell us, but I'll tell you. It's probably Pharaoh Sennacherib III. How do we know this? Because prior to Pharaoh Sennacherib III, Egypt was kind of like England in the early Middle Ages. You had a king, but the real power lay in all the barons, you know, all the earls and the dukes and the earls and the baronies all around England. And so if he wanted to get to war, he had to convince his dukes and earls and barons to give him men to go to war, because he did not have a big enough army to go to war with by himself. These dukes and these barons and these earls, they had all the land, they had the men, you know, and the king was over London, but he really had to have the support of all these other nobles to get anything done. And that's the way it was in Egypt. Pharaoh's the head man, but there are a whole lot of powerful landowners who really drive the country. Pharaoh can't just tell them what to do and go do that. What happens in the reign of Pharaoh Sennacherib III is the Pharaoh begins purchasing all this land. He begins to purchase everyone's land, and suddenly, by the end of his reign, he owns all of Egypt. How did that happen? Because Joseph created this principle of a 20% tax. Everything that people made, they gave 20% to Pharaoh. And Joseph took that grain and he stored it away, because he knew these 7 years of famine were coming. And people really didn't mind, because these are years of plenty. They have excess. They have all kinds of things for it. So they give up a fifth, yeah, that's a lot, but hey, you know. But they were willing to do that. Then when the 7 years of famine hit, they need grain. They're starving. So they start buying grain from Pharaoh. When they run out of money, they start selling their livestock. When they run out of livestock, they start selling their land to Pharaoh. All for this grain that Joseph has stored up. And then by the end of his reign, Pharaoh owns all of Egypt. So we see this link in the Bible. Happens, you know, we can see where it happened in the history of Egypt. So it's always interesting to follow those through. All right, so what are the principles here? What do we learn? The scripture is given to us to learn. We can learn principles that God has given us to live by studying the scriptures. And one of them we see right here. That when times are good, save a little, because times will be bad. You know? I have never seen anybody that's had a life that just everything was hunky-dory for their whole lives. There are good times and there are hard times. That's just the way life is. Doesn't mean God's happy with you when there are good times and mad at you when there are bad times. It's just the way life is. We have good times, we have hard times. And a principle that Joseph teaches us here is, in the good times, store a little up, because the hard times are sure to come. And it's just the way life is. But a couple other things that we learn. Another principle we learn is that God is faithful to prosper those who are faithful to him. Now, Joseph had a rugged, rugged life, right? He's sold into slavery. He's wrongly accused. He spends 3 years in a dungeon. But throughout all of this, he remains faithful. He doesn't get mad at God, doesn't blame God. He stays faithful to God and will remain faithful to God to the end. But God is also faithful and raises him up. This is a principle we see all through Scripture, right? Abraham, year after year after year, no child. God promised to make him a nation, but he doesn't have a kid. Abraham remains faithful. And when he's 100 or 110, I forget, he's an old man. God gives him his kid. God remains faithful. But it's not like it's all smooth sail. It's not like the prosperity gospel, you know. Give me 10 bucks and God will give you 100. You know, it doesn't work that way. But staying faithful through the hard days of life, and God will bring you through. And for many of us, that the faith, we won't see the faithfulness of God until we're in heaven. I mean, I'm not us here. We're okay. We live in the U.S. You know, things are good. But I tell you what, if you're a Christian in Mosul, you remaining faithful to God probably means you're going to be dead. But God remains faithful to those who are faithful to him, and he receives them eternally. So whatever comes in this life, stay faithful, and God will be faithful. And the one last thing to mention is, as I've already kind of mentioned, is Joseph as that type of Christ, sold for silver, into slavery, wrongly accused, 3 years in the belly of the earth, and then being raised to his rightful position. And that's what we all look for. Faithful when wrong things happen to us. But I like what we read from St. Peter. If you're going to get persecuted, if you're going to be punished, get punished for doing something good. Get punished for being righteous, not for doing something evil. Next week, we'll continue the story of Joseph and see what happens now that Joseph is vizier of Egypt and his brothers will come back needing some grain because they'll be starving too. All right? Thanks be to God. Let's go to God in our prayers.